Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we discuss living your life as an analytic meditation, Carl Jung's active imagination and transcendental functions, having concern for the expression of our ideas, integrating with your own mind and connecting with our objective psyche, free association as an acknowledgement of our continual flow of thoughts, the obstacles and potential solutions to meditation and journeying while working with our own tendencies, psyche, and mindscapes. Enjoy the episode. We definitely had a good time recording it.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese, Medicinism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Two thumbs up.
Hey, fellow GNTers, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. Daniel gave me the two thumbs up.
That's right.
Minor distraction technique that did not throw me. It's all about the professionalism.
That's right.
Tantra, not. All right. So we wanted to do follow up on what we were doing. We've been doing these episodes on the Book of Job. If you've been following along, Carl Jung, his answer to Job. And Daniel brought up at the end of the last episode, this idea of doing something that was more experience driven. Based on the idea of people saying, do things that are experience-driven. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that totally meant to you. I don't know if you want to say something about that, Dan. You want to comment?
I remember it, but I don't remember what the significance was.
Well, this is like our relationship with one another. Daniel says this, and I took it to heart. And he's like, I don't even remember saying it.
You're like, I don't know.
We both did our impressions on this.
No, I remember. I remember now. I remember now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. You want to share?
No.
Okay. All right. This is a very professional podcast.
Yeah, this is very.
Okay. When you were saying it, I was like, well, I don't know what that would mean exactly, in the sense that I want to say one thing real quick about this first before we get into the full meat of this, but because I see everything we do as kind of like an analytic meditation.
Yeah.
And I had never come across that concept until I started doing things in the Tibetan Buddhist world.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously one of our home bases for this. We have a Zen base out there. We have a Taoist base. We have Kabbalistic base, Sufi base, so on. But definitely a Tibetan tantric base. And they use this idea of analytic meditation, which is where you meditate on ideas. And you think of things that you think are challenging and thoughtful, and you contemplate them.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I see everything we're doing has a practicality to it, in the sense that it's like one long analytic meditation. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's not an infinitely long, because we're not going to be around for infinity, but at least
we'll come back again and we'll find each other and we'll start this shit back up again.
Yeah, but for the length of this podcast, it is, you know, a consecutive practice of an analytic meditation for sure. And I think many things are that way, but the way in which you're bringing it up now, which is what we do, right, is to consciously approach things. And so, yes, it's conversation, it's education, it's some humor, it's some observations, you know, some experience, some authenticity, some creativity, all of these kind of things that are naturally occurring from within us based on our education and clinical work and whatever. But when you give it the language that helps to connect what you're doing on a mundane level to things that you're doing simultaneously on a spiritual level, that's the tantra. That's Jin and tantra, right? Jin is in spirits, as in things that we do to alter our consciousness, right? Because that's what alcohol does. And then the tantra is the weaving of this kind of like altered state with the conscious state. The weaving of abstract thought to kind of rational thought. And so as we are having these conversations over the last 3 years, you know, recorded, I mean, these are conversations that you and I have had for the last 10 years, really, that we bring it to the forefront of people's minds to understand that it is not, yes, it is the musings of two guys in the Chicagoland area with, you know, similar but different experiences, but it is a version of living meditation. You know, when people talk about taking their practice off the cushion or the yoga mat, you know, for people who practice yoga, for me, when I say that to people or when I hear it being said, the way I interpret it is that, like, you should be living the way, living and approaching the way that you do things with an air of mindfulness, you know, with an air of how is this moving with the flow of my life, you know, and the things that I find as difficult, or, well, maybe we'll just say either obstacles or tough sticking points, can I approach them in such a way that I can learn from them? And I think the best way to do that is to think of things in a meditative practice, and meaning you're open to interpretations that are not directly coming from you. You know, you let yourself be open to that.
I like this idea of, well, the analytic meditation be where you, like, analytic meditation being where you have, like, ideas that you're exposed to and you contemplate in quiet moments.
Mm-hmm.
I like that idea, which I think is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I also really like the turn of phrase for, like, a living meditation, because I think about that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like your life should be integrated with that meditative experience.
Yes.
That your life is part of the meditative experience too. And it's part of the teaching experience of how you live your life. So yeah, I like the idea of living meditation. I think I'm gonna start using that. I like it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so it's meditation is in your quiet moments. But I think when people think about meditation, they think you count your breath or you focus on some particular thing. But in this Tibetan world, you can do this analytic meditation, which is you contemplate certain ideas.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, what we're trying to do here. But then also the idea that your meditation, your life should match your meditation. It should go together. It should be a reflection.
Yes.
Right. They sometimes talk about that idea of union, and there's going to be a lot of stuff about union here. But this idea that there should be a union of your experience when you're in the meditative stage or when you're in those private moments, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And your actual life, they should mm-hmm. unify. It's funny, on the Carl Jung thing, I didn't have this in the notes or anything for this now, but when he was young, he talked about this experience of having, like, two different people. And one seemed to be the person he was when he was out in his life, and the other person seemed to be the one that he had in his private moments. And I think if you have had this experience yourself, it's a very interesting and powerful one, you know, and to, like, hang that observation out there. Cause I definitely have had that feeling, like, there's the me that's out in the world at times, and then there's the me that's my own private self, my more meditative and private and self-reflective moments, and they may not match.
Correct.
And that doesn't feel good. And I guess that's the idea of living meditation, that your life should reflect those private moments and back and forth. It shouldn't be like this big divorce. I don't think that's good. I certainly didn't feel good to me. I should say it that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the living meditation, I like that phrase. I'm into it.
Mm-hmm. And if we can pay off something from the last episode when we were kind of talking about Sophia.
I had a lot on Sophia here though. So it's going to be popping up a bunch.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, just before we go into it, I think I wanted to talk about that. And that was why, you know, I know we're going to talk about it, which is why I didn't want to talk about it earlier, because I know we're going there. I had thought about the question I asked was, like, well, how do we embody this in a practice, or how does this, you know, fit for us? And just, you know, probably as a prelude to what's coming, but in the moment, what is definitely present for me right now is that, like, the highlighting of those two aspects of life, right? Building on this idea of a living meditation and the sort of analytic or reflective state. That when you're sitting, for most people, and this is a broad generalization, so understand that there's much nuance. I know you know this, Eric, but I'm talking to the audience. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, we all, it's good that we all hear it.
Yeah.
Reflective
kind of open state of receptivity, whether it be analytic or reflection or quiet, whatever it is that you're doing, this can be viewed, at least the way that I think is that we're attempting to kind of quell the sort of monkey mind, the temporary mind, so that your ability to be one with a deeper wisdom is part of this, like, we'll call it a feminine practice. It doesn't mean feminine is like sexuality feminine, but I want to reference the idea of, like, Sophia as wisdom, mm-hmm. that you're quelling the kind of, like, chitter chatter so that you can tap into that deeper level of wisdom that's kind of always there and pervasive in my mind. And then that is juxtaposed to then like the living part, which is a little bit more of action, a little bit more process driven, a little bit more of male, you know, masculine in this way.
If you go to like standard Chinese definitions, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to think of masculine and feminine at all if that doesn't resonate with you.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm
masculine is one way. If you went to India, Shiva's the quiet one, Shakti's the active one.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be masculine or feminine. You can see, so you can let that sit however that sits with each individual person. You know what I mean? So anyone listening, you can kind of take that however you want. It doesn't have to be one way or the other.
No, totally not.
As far as so that then, kind of language, but
So then we could say that one is a wisdom-based practice and one is an action-based practice. You know what I'm saying?
I hadn't really thought about that. Back in my Zen days, they made a huge deal about this, which maybe is where that started to really kick with me. You know, that you would do things that were the sitting Zen meditation, but then you'd go and you do the active things. Some of that was like special sword forms that were very martial arts things that honestly were based on the five phases, the energies of Chinese medicine. And there was a part of the sword form for each of the five phases, which was pretty cool. So that was like doing things in movement, like doing Tai Chi.
Yeah.
Doing something that has a movement aspect to it. And then, you know, you do other things that were like keeping this going as you were doing activities.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's the idea.
That's the
now
idea.
Now we're getting to the point of the living meditation. When we get to it, we'll probably be like, well, then how do you construct your own life?
Yes.
And I think the thing that I keep going back to, and, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, I think challenging the way of life that you're given and building a life that suits what you think has spiritual meaning and integrity and authenticity for you, that's the thing. It's going to keep coming back. So it's going to come back in an interesting way when we do the stuff that Jung did. So,
yeah.
All right, cool. So we got context. So I decided to look like what Jung did more specifically, and there are two big ideas and nice little phrases for them too. So one is the idea that Jung had of what's called active imagination, and the other is what he calls the transcendent function. So we'll kind of go through them, and this will give maybe the concrete idea of someone who wanted to have a specific kind of a, you know, like what would you do concretely if you wanted to kind of do this kind of inner journeying, this kind of maybe ultimately connecting to Sophia, if that's a goal, right? I want to give a little bit of credit to the bassist from Blondie, Gary Lachman, because he uses these phrases. He points this out in his book called Jung the Mystic. Oops, here he is. Jung the Mystic. So I went to this one to just see how he commented on these two ideas. So I'm giving credit where credit is due. It's the old 70s group Blondie. Once I had love and it was a gas, soon found out be a pain in the ass, heart of glass, Blondie. But anyways, you know, he comments on this and he's an interesting cat. I don't know, maybe reach out to him at some point and get him on the show. That might be kind of fun. You know, we mean to do more of that kind of thing. But anyways, just to give him his props. So active imagination seems like the first one to cover. One of the interesting things that he points out, which is a truth of Jung's life overall, is that he kept these things pretty secret.
Yeah.
He started working on these ideas of active imagination like in the 19-teens, 1917, 1918, 1915. He was working these ideas of what it meant to do these inner journeying experiences. He got very deep into it after his break with Freud. And he was in kind of a personal crisis because he was so connected to Freud and this whole community of people around Freud. And there's a whole drama around that. But when they actually did kind of part ways, you know, he was in the point of crisis. And this is sort of what he did is sort of his own inner psychology into this point of crisis. And he does say that this is something interesting that you can do this during times of crisis and distress. It's a natural thing to do. As we go through, we'll kind of talk more about that, I guess. But it's interesting that he kept it secret for so long. Apparently he didn't. He showed it to other people who were in sort of his close set of circles of people who were his confidants and people who were, you know, intellectual peers and people he shared things with that were more of that type. But he didn't like actively talk about this very much. And I can't remember the years, but it might have taken him decades before he even started using these phrases. So there's a weird question as to why. And I just wanted to talk briefly about the why and then get your thoughts on this because I was curious what your reaction would be.
On the
one hand, he was afraid that it would look non-scientific. So he's afraid of that, you know, and maybe because he was competing with other psychologists who were kind of putting on the mantle of scientificness you know, he didn't want to look non-scientific by comparison or something. He seems to be very worried about that. The other part was whether or not people would just thought he was crazy. to say you do these inner journeying and find these inner figures within yourself. We're going to talk about this more in detail. We thought, well, people just think of me like I'm a crazy person, just talking to parts of my own mind, and I'm just deluded or hallucinatory or something. Mm-hmm. And so he was really afraid of those critiques. And I think there's reason for that, because later on people throw this shit at him. He was just a crazy person.
Mm.
Right. But it really goes to show, I thought it would be interesting to bring up and hear your response, Daniel, because it really shows what people's attitudes are towards these things. And he was afraid of it, and probably to some percentage rightfully so, because, you know, he was just afraid of that judgmentalness about what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That people just find him crazy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably right. The ideas that were growing during that period really kind of flowered, at least in the U.S., you know, in the movement of the 60s and early 70s, you know.
It takes decades, really.
Yeah, and it took a long time for people to be open enough to express how they felt in a public setting. It was probably safe to do so previously, like, with, you know, they probably could have did it in the 50s or probably, you know what I'm saying? But like, society just didn't, it didn't seem like that was appropriate, you know what I'm saying? And people still felt fear around being themselves. And we see this now, you know, with, you know, movements in the LGBT community, or, you know, all the other letters that are part of that, you know, no offense to anybody. I'm just, you know, whatever. I know what I know. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. And so people are expressing themselves more now, which is why I do say, like, we're lucky that we get to express opinions. It wasn't that long ago, you know, and even in other countries, like in Russia, you know, you couldn't express, I mean, even now, really, but before, you know, they were looking for people who were not communist, you know, who were against it, and they would jail you, you know. Family members would snitch out on other family members because they'd be fearful that the neighbor would know that the family member knew that they weren't telling on their brother or sister or something like that. So the fact that, like, we get to do this now is a real gift. And in relation to Carl Jung, even though he was I don't know if he was an industry leader, you know, at the time
he was a famous person, and he was rich, independently wealthy, you know, through marriage, like
through marriage,
a person. He was like, you know, a famous psychologist before any of this stuff came up. So, I mean, he was like, apparently internationally, like, he was just as, like, well known as Freud in the beginning, okay, you know, through his own work. But he felt the insecurity of, like, the idea of, like, okay, people will dismiss what I'm doing as kind of non-scientific and wacky.
Right. Right.
And actually, you know, like, you do shamanistic things. I mean, there's still the point where people might go, well, that's just wacky. You said you had a vision, like, it's just some shit your mind made up.
And this is unfortunately why I don't often use, well, I mean, it takes energy. So first, but second of all, I don't often use it. And when I have before, the people who come, even though they want, that's what they want. They want an experience, you know, they want to see something. And the couple times that they ask for it, they get it. And they have no idea what to do with it. There's no frame of reference. They're like, what?
That's interesting, because that's his third point. He says, like, there's kind of three ideas that Jung was concerned about. One was, I'll be judged for being non-scientific by other people who are trying to be biological.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll be judged as being kind of crazy. Like, people think I have, like, delusions and, you know, I'm mentally unstable, wacky. And then the last point was that these things can be challenging. And I think I wanted to, like, do the technique and then return back to the idea, if you're cool with that, Daniel.
Yeah, let's do it.
But, like, the challenging part is kind of interesting, because it could be challenging in, like, different kinds of ways.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do it.
Okay, cool. So here's what he was doing. And it makes sense. It's a kind of an inner journeying, though he didn't use that exact phrase.
No, he did not.
This phrase more like active imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea goes, sorry, my voice is being a little funky. His idea is that you enter into kind of a reverie. It's similar to maybe like a hypnagogia, where you kind of, like, are falling asleep and your mind starts to daydream around those kinds of states, right?
Yeah, you get, you relax. Yeah. You're in a relaxed place.
It's interesting in, like, the Tibetan Buddhist world, because you pay so much attention to how you fall asleep. And it's like a weird process, because if you concentrate too hard,
cannot sleep.
I can't fall asleep.
No.
And it's a little hard sometimes with these meditations. They're very difficult. They're probably the hardest meditations I've ever had to do in my whole life. And I probably don't do them as good, well, as I should. but, you know, if you concentrate too hard, it's just hard to fall asleep. And so, you know, you have to let your mind go to where it starts to reverie a little bit. It starts to kind of go around and like see stuff, you know, like it starts to produce images. It starts to do stuff. You can pay attention. If you start to fall asleep, your mind will do this, right? All of a sudden you're like, you realize like you're flying over a field and there's some water and this and that. You'll start seeing shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very cool. And you have to let your mind do it. And if you don't do that, you might not fall asleep.
Yes.
I can remember being young and kind of realizing that. And I would think about the girls in the class that I liked. I was like 12 years old or something.
That'll keep you up.
I'd be thinking and revering, and then I might fall asleep. I was a little bit young. I wasn't going to get like a full-on, you know, erectile experiences.
Erectile experiences.
Yeah, because I was still too young. I was still in an innocent romanticist state. But anyways, yeah, you're right. Otherwise, it would be hard to fall asleep.
Literally.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Sorry.
That's really funny because I have an 11-year-old and this would mortify him. But, you know, this does happen now. And he's like, oh, my God. And I'm like, yeah, don't worry about it. It's totally fine.
You're like, it's fine.
Totally fine. Dude, you don't have, you know, you won't even believe where this is going to go next.
Yeah, it's going to ruin your life and make it great. So
this is going to be quite a talk about inner journey.
Yeah.
This is going to be a journey. Okay, so for example, for Jung, but here's where you're trying to be more proactive about it, I guess, right? So for him, he might imagine like entering into a cave. I think he did that some of the time, right? Entering into some space, some special space. And then the big thing is, from his point, is that you want to try to find the figures who encounter you inside, right? You know, if you go into these spaces, what you might start to find happening is that you'll meet people, right, who are occupying the space. Now, again, this gets to the idea of the archetypes, right? The real famous Jungian thing about these primordial ideas within the human mind, mother, father, masculine, feminine, tricksters and shadows and all these different Jungian archetype figures.
Mm.
But he was more sort of having this experiential thing where I'll just go into the space and I won't necessarily think I'm going to meet anyone in particular, but let me see who I meet.
Right.
Figures are that I end up kind of running into. And as you do this, then he says, especially what you want to do is you want to ask questions. And you want to start engaging in a dialogue with whoever the people are that you meet. And especially you want to ask questions and things that you might not know the answer to, not in the sense of like, how many pounds are in a ton? Mm. Not those kind of answers, but answers to things like within the context of your life, things that you're uncertain of, mm-hmm. things that you want clarification of, and then you'll start to talk. And probably these figures will start talking back to you, which raises a kind of interesting question. Are you dialoguing with yourself or parts of yourself? Are you dialoguing with things that are outside and bigger than yourself on some level? That's kind of a Jungian question to ask. And maybe we'll continue to explore that as we go, but worthwhile thinking about. But the other thing I thought that was really interesting, Daniel, is there was a whole thing about it's similar when you go and you ask yourself questions about your own life, when you talk with yourself. Blondie Basis makes this point. We do things like this. We go and we say, hey, what do we think about this? And then we answer ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we do something like this, you know? But I think what's interesting about that, and he sort of makes this point, not in these exact words, but the thing that struck me about this is that when you're doing that a lot of times in your more mundane everyday life situations, you're not making something special happen. A lot of times what you're probably talking to is your own like default mode network. If we want to go back for flashbacks for previous episodes.
Yeah.
You know, the part of the brain that just churns along stupidly saying shit throughout the course of your day, probably making you miserable, right? Default mm-hmm. mode network, or the existential guardian operating system, if you want to go that route, right?
Mm-hmm.
This, that's one of Daniel's phrases for this. We had episodes on that concept, you know, one of Daniel's turns of phrases. So, you know, a lot of times that's something where it's just blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But this, you're trying to get into something deeper. Some deeper part of your own consciousness or your own psyche, which is interesting, right? That you try to do this. It's a deeper kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They also drew the difference here then between this and something like free association, which is a psychological technique where you just let your mind kind of go wherever it goes. which is also cool. But I think the point about that is a lot of that will just end up spitting back a lot of blah, blah, blah at you. It'll end up being a lot of default mode network stuff. You know, the more mundane parts of your personality, right? Not necessarily the deeper parts of who you are. The Buddhist Tantra on that is something like you'll get a lot of mundane conceptions and mundane appearances. So I think the thing in the Jungian world is you have to get someplace outside of that so you get to someplace deeper. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, because interacting with your own mind produces the results you would expect.
A lot of it's interacting with parts of yourself that are kind of mundane.
Yeah. I mean, it's talking to a mirror. You would expect that you would get an answer that you would give. You know?
Yeah.
If you were to tell somebody that, hey, I had a conversation with myself and this is what I came up with. If that person was being honest, they would say, yeah, that sounds just like you. which is what's supposed to happen because you're talking to yourself. But you know, going back to that the aspect of connecting with wisdom in a seated meditation in a place of reflection, that was my point, is that when you can quiet the chatter.
That's really, you have to like, but if you look at it like the course of like what struck me about this in the course of most people's lives and most people's decision making. Most people when they're under duress and they're trying to make major decisions in their life and so on, they're just talking to themselves.
Yeah.
Which means they're probably talking to relatively mundane parts of themselves.
Correct.
They're just going to blah, blah, blah back the things that they would probably naturally say anyways.
And your ability to find deep states of reflection during turbulent periods will be probably hampered by your lack of practice, and thereby in those moments more difficult for you to connect to the parts of you that are probably actually wanting to speak. But because you haven't built those muscles, or you haven't, you know, deepened those grooves, or those habits or disciplines are not set in your life, it's very difficult to get out to the middle of the ocean when everything is very turbulent near the shore.
Especially if you've never learned to swim.
Yeah. Yep. And you're wearing, anchors on your feet for shoes.
Yeah. Yeah. There was like back in the day, and it was like a bad moment. I don't think I handled it perfectly, but I had a student who was having trouble energetically while giving an acupuncture treatment. He came out feeling really affected by whatever had happened. And he was like, can you give me a meditation now to fix this? And I was like, I mean, I can give you something,
sure, but
you haven't built it up.
Right.
To be able to do it. So you're probably not going to be able to do this in the moment when you need to.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of looked at me like I was being an asshole, and maybe I was. You know, I wasn't trying to be. I was just like, oh man, you know, it's tough because I can describe this to you, but will you be able to do this now? Probably not, you know, because you're going to be more, you have to build the momentum of those things up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there's always beginner's luck.
Yeah. I wasn't like not going to tell him like, no,
no,
no, you didn't do it before. So you're screwed. So, tough love, Johnny.
Eric the mentor. That's it.
Smoke up, Johnny.
Yeah. You'll be
like,
fine.
You know, like Let's breakfast go. Club thing.
Yeah.
Tough it up.
Here, drink water.
Yeah. Tie your shoes and clean your room and pull your shit together. No.
Oh, advice from Jordan Peterson, eh?
Jordan Peterson wisdom.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's kind of an interesting thing, right? So the argument goes that instead of like just seeing even maybe necessarily parts of yourself, though this is a huge question, you can call it the collective unconscious, and it's interesting because sometimes this will get called the objective psyche, meaning things that are kind of bigger than you're seeing, not just like a reflection of your own personality, but things that are a little bit more transcendent of your mundane personality.
Mm.
Are they you? Are they not you? Kind of a tough question. We'll kind of explore it as we go, right? But in any case, you know, that's the idea. And it's an interesting turn of phrase to call that the objective psyche, meaning it's not your subjective personhood, not what you would normally identify as you. It's something else that you're seeing into that on some level feels separate from you,
mm-hmm.
which at the very least means it's separate from your default mode network.
Correct.
Or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Now the point is that this happens in dreams. This can happen in painting, writing, sculpture, dance, creative activities. But in this method that Jung is trying to like trying to figure out here and eventually share, the idea is that you're trying to do this in a more direct way. Again, not letting the mind just wander, because that'll be free association. And as is pointed out by the basis Blondie guy, will probably just trigger your own issues and complexes. And that's what you'll be listening to. You'll be listening to them. And they'll be talking to you. So you have to get out of that, which I think is a great observation. There has to be something like that, where you're just not listening to your own issues.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're really like that, you know, that's an astute observation, I think. That's a profound observation. If you just kind of let, okay, let me follow my mind and see, it'll just be your own shit, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Your own issues, your own fears, your own limitations, your own preconceived ideas, and so on. That's what your mind will produce.
Mm-hmm.
That's the default mode network, right? That's what it's going to do. So he says, like, you know, within this stuff, you have to find these more deeper parts inside you and then kind of catch on to them when you find them, which I think is another good observation, right? It's a kind of a self-reflection that's more energetically driven to find those things. And then you connect to them and then you enter into the dialogue with them. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then Jung says, if it's a speaking figure at all, then you should talk with it, right? And then that figure will start to talk back. And I'll give some examples of like Jung's own experiences with this as we go. But yeah, but that's the idea.
It is burning in my mind right now. I don't know where I learned this or if I learned this, but this is related to this directly. And the challenge was presented to me to look in the mirror without judgment. Look in the mirror without any judgment at all, without any dialogue at all, just to see yourself as somebody else would, as if you were a complete stranger on the street walking by. And it would seem to me that this is an internal kind of a thing as well. Like as you're going through this kind of active imagination, to be able to remove the story from the experience, you know, and to be able to connect to the actual part there that is there to be connected with, that is not attached to the threads that we place on things in order to make them fit neatly into a story, so that it doesn't roll around in our mind or our hearts for longer than we would prefer it to, you know, as a method of defense, you know, or as a method of integration, or as a method of dismissal.
The parallelism. The parallelism is to kind of just sit there and not let all the mundane conceptions and appearances, to use the Buddhist tantric phrase,
mm-hmm.
dominate, because it's mm-hmm. certainly possible when you look at yourself, all the same stuff will be said over and over again just by your mind in some reactive way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I get the parallelism. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to step back and like skirt that somehow, transcend that, work around it, whatever the right directionality image is for that.
Sure. Yeah.
You have to go through it.
And for some people, actually, this is like, you know, we're touching a little bit on Chinese medicine, but the methods to which that people can do this are probably going to vary person to person and probably a little bit by their elemental type.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will have to like let it, we'll have to find a way to release it, to let it go, because they're holding on to, we'll call it previous conditioning or something else like this.
I think that's going to be across the board, though. I mean, I think that you have to say is just a thing, right?
Yeah.
People have that, right?
But then other people I have found have kind of like an ingenious way of asking for it to be done for them, and then it happens.
Well, maybe.
I mean,
I guess it depends what's spit out.
Sure.
I mean?
Sure.
I'm not being dubious. I'm not being skeptical about, but I would be a little bit. It depends on what it's spit out. If it's just
whether I think,
it's just more of what you would say, then you probably, who knows? You know what I mean?
Well, I think what I'm referring to is probably not totally, I mean, it's related to this, but it's in relation to doing a meditative practice where people were having a hard time with their own thoughts getting in the way of doing a mantra or having a visualization. And then some people were able to find ways to like let it go. They could see it as a color floating in the sky or smoke coming from their nose or their mouth. And then other people who weren't able to, you know, didn't want to do that with their own sort of being, asked for help from somebody, something. Mm-hmm. And then they said that they were just completely clear and were able to have this visualization with details I did not provide.
I guess the thing with, yeah. So I guess if you're really tapping into the whole Jungian thing is that you tap into some deeper part of yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess it like, it's however you get there is how you get there. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he gives an example of a patient of his where this was sort of like, what am I being asked to do here exactly? And this patient describes sitting in a train station, and there was a large poster, like a travel poster for like the Swiss Alps or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he, okay, just like, I'm going to imagine myself going into this poster. So he just kind of had, again, this reverie of going into the poster, and he started walking inside the poster. So now he's going through some special space, right? In this case, some spot up in the mountains, right?
They'll call this a portal.
Yeah. And so he saw a chapel. There was a statue of the Virgin Mary. And then he said some creature appeared with like pointy ears. That was not like part of what he was in any way consciously trying to imagine. This mm-hmm. little creature just popped up and then it disappeared. And he was like, okay. But then it came back again. And he was like, oh. So this isn't exactly me doing this. Something else is happening. And he said, well, okay, that's how this patient learned what Jung was talking about. And Jung was like, yeah, it's something like that. Something will happen that you start to feel is a little bit bigger than maybe what would be the normal confines of how you see and think about things.
Mm-hmm.
However you get there, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had more you wanted to do on the elemental part of that? I mean,
No. It's fine because it's okay. I mean, this is the part though. This is the important part. So, and this goes back to something I wanted to touch on earlier when we were talking about meditation. People sit or they talk about, at least when they talk to me about it, because I talk about it a lot. When they say, oh, I can't meditate because I can't quiet my mind. And I said, oh, I didn't realize that was something you should be doing. You know, they're like, well, isn't that the point? I said, I don't know. What is the point? Maybe you should illuminate me as to the point of what you think meditation is so we can have at least a discussion on the frame of reference that we're talking about. Because I think we're coming at it from two different points. Now, I understand what they're saying, but some people come, they want to relax, you know, so they look at meditation as like a stress relief technique or some kind of like, you know, blood pressure hack, something like this, you know,
and it is stuff on that later on too. So yeah, I'm gonna come back to that idea.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to like take it away, but I had the same thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So which it does those things, it's a byproduct of those things, which we've talked about before, you know, like we've definitely shit on meditation as a life hack numerous times, but it's worth doing. So do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's not a life hack. That's the, right. That's the irony.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no. For me, it's a key that unlocks the door to the path. Mm-hmm. But that's not a hack. That requires actually more work. So like
you probably have to change.
Yeah, but there you go. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
So your ability to find the ways in which that you can quiet some of that random chatter, that is the way, you know, but like even if we were to highlight numerous ways that you can go about, and we have already, we've given two, right? Letting things go, or we've talked before about cutting them off using like a scissors or a knife or a sword or something like this, or asking for help. Those are three different methods. One's own creative nature will arise with enough practice to help somebody in various times as they progress in their practice. But those steps cannot be missed. They cannot be skipped and they cannot be gifted to you. It is those, for me, that is the transformative part. When you're able to do those things, when you're able to work with yourself in that particular way, in that very, very particular way. And I, just so we're clear, I'm referencing us working with our own stream of consciousness, our own thoughts that are looping and swirling. If you can find a way to work with that, that will change you. Because in those moments, then you start to have interaction with things that are unconscious moving into your consciousness. And then you can start to break that stream. You can start to break that flow and you can have a sense of, you know, that's the beginning of freedom. You know, at least in my mind, that's the beginning of your saying, I'm not going to be the whipping boy or whipping gal or whipping person to the drives and inherent natures that are me, that are controlling me in the way that I'm not even aware of. Influencing my decisions and actions.
The mundane conceptions and appearances of my own mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That have been,
I think, yeah.
That have been influenced by culture, society, parents, religion, all that other stuff. You know, it's just, it's just
negative experience. On you. My own upbringing, potentially, right?
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. And genetics traumas. And, you know, yeah. all the other, you know, all of
karma.
Karma. Yeah. We've talked yeah. about this at nausea, but this is what I'm referencing. And so it's difficult and it's a continually unfolding process. So what you learn in the beginning will help you so far. And then you have to learn it again and again and again and again on a deeper level, you know, but as you do that, you're unlocking, it's like trying to put the Rubik's cube together with being, I don't know, blind or blindfolded. You'll eventually make it work, you know, and you'll get it all lined up right. But until you try.
Maybe more optimistic than like putting the Rubik's cube blindfolded. That might be a hard task. Like, wow, that sounds really difficult. Yeah, but in any case, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I don't think in Jung, where I hesitated for a moment was he doesn't seem to like say anything about what to do with that flow of free association, which ultimately is probably your own complexes.
Yes.
Except maybe a recognition. There are things like in the Mahamudra teachings in Tibetan meditation and so on, that maybe similar things in Zen, you could cut like with a sword. They talk about that.
Yep.
They also talk about the idea that you can go and just let things just fly away. Like you're out in the ocean and you let a bird go, it'll just fly off the deck, but then come back again, right? Mm-hmm. The bird will wander and come back because it has nowhere else to go. So the bird flying away is like the wandering thoughts and it'll come back again. Because where else is the bird going to go? It's in the middle of the ocean. It has to go back, right? Where there's also the idea of, you know, the more of the sword imagery or those kinds of things, right? Where you're more cutting, which is a little bit more of a, but the funny thing is, I mean, he doesn't talk about that. So I was a little bit like, what should I say about that? I wasn't sure, but you know, that stuff is there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think the main point he's making is to make the distinction between your mundane mind and this other part.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That seems to be what he's asking you to notice or something.
Mm-hmm.
But with the idea then that you're going to tap into this other part. So maybe it's building on the exercise. The other way he kind of this gets talked about is you could take a dark mood or a problem and let that crystallize into some kind of image.
Yeah.
And then interact with that and see what that has to say.
We had brought this up when we were talking a long time ago at this point about that book, Why Buddhism is True, The Science Behind Meditation and Enlightenment.
That's the is it Robert Wright or Richard Wright? I forget his name.
Yeah. 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 And in that book, he uses the acronym RAIN, right? Which we've talked about before, but we'll bring it up again because it's been a long time. Recognize, acknowledge, investigate, and non-attach. And if we're going to, let's say a dark mood or, you know, rough
spot. What's the A in that? Recognize? What's the A again?
Acknowledge.
Acknowledge. Okay.
Okay. So we'll say you're having some, you know, let's go heavy. You're having some, you know, my life is meaningless type thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. And you're able to sit and you have a meditative practice. And that just means that you could just be sitting in quiet reflection for 5 minutes or, you know, you need more than that, but let's just say 5 minutes here. Okay. Cause this stuff can happen almost instantaneously if you can do it, you know? So you're paying attention to yourself. And then you recognize I have this very negative voice going on in my head saying my life is not worth living. Okay. So that's the recognition that it's there. You give it a little bit of light. Okay. It's here. Then I have to say it is here. So the recognition and the acknowledgement, one is kind of like feeling something with your eyes closed. There's something that you're feeling, but then when you open your up, you go, oh wow, this is a thing that's here. This is a, you know, paper bag full of baseballs. I don't know.
Not just going to let it go. I'm going to actually like own it, acknowledge that it's there,
yep.
Really fully say, okay, I'm going to like,
yeah,
I'm going to really accept this as a thing. I'm not going to take it just as some fleeting thing that passed. And now I'm going to like pretend like it never happened at all.
Correct. Yep. Correct. Then you're going to investigate it. And this is the part that why it brought this to my mind, because you're the investigation is the sort of characterization of the thing. How does it feel? How does it sound? How does it smell? And when I say feeling, yes, emotional, but I also mean, how does it feel? Does it have a texture? Is it rough? Is it smooth? Is it bumpy? Is it squared? Is it circular? Is it contained? Is it sticky? You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. You want to give it as good of a description as you can, because you're acknowledging it is part of you at the moment. And then once you have it as, you know, categorized as you can, with this investigation, then you will, then you can finally let it go, because you have done the investigation part to know where it is.
Jung's take would be something like, as you get to this point where it starts to happen, it'll probably like start to auto go away.
Yeah.
A lot of the power will kind of go away from it or something.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Fritz Perls, who's the founder of this school called the Gestalt School of Psychology.
Mm.
And he had this thing about dreams, which I kind of share in some of the classes where this comes up, where I have to teach stuff on psychology for traditional Chinese medical people. But, you know, he said, like, when you have a dream, since you're interacting with your own mind, now he's not making the deal that you're interacting with the deeper parts of your collective unconscious. He's not saying that here. So that's a distinction. I don't want to let that go, because that is a little bit of a different thing in Jung. But he is saying, like, you're interacting with your own mind. And so that means that anything that appears in the dream, when you're woken up later on, you can still go, okay, I remember that dream. It was very powerful or disturbing or whatever it was. I can go back and I can talk to anything in that dream.
Mm-hmm.
That personification of things is really interesting, right? Mm-hmm. You go back and you say, I'll talk to whatever figure is then in that dream, and I'll like figure out what it means, you know, as you mm-hmm. go through it. Again, have we ever mm-hmm. talked about this here on the podcast? I can't remember.
Well, I had mentioned to you, but and if I've mentioned it on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, I'm repeating myself to our audience, I apologize, but I've had two dreams in the last few weeks where I have woken up within my dream to tell the other people that are in my dream that they are a part of me.
Okay.
And that I am now going to meditate and you're going to go away. And that I can prove to them that I am me and that they are me, because we are connected by manipulating reality or manipulating myself. You know, so I'll say, oh, you think we're in a building now? Now we're not. We're in a field. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, you don't think that I can fly? Bye. You know, I come back up, I sit back down, like, no, you are me. I know it, because I know what you're going to say. I know what you're going to think, because that's what I would think, because this is me.
So I think, like, yeah. So that's basically the idea. You can mm-hmm. talk to the figures in your dreams. Now, mm-hmm. other people's dreams are intrinsically boring. So that's just what it is. Gelug Rinpoche was very honest about that and very true about that.
Yeah.
But you know, when you look at, like, if you've had a disturbing dream, you can go back and you can just say, okay, like, who are the people in this dream, you know? And I've done this, you know, sometimes where it's been like, oh, that's a really powerful one, you know, even mm-hmm. dreams that were very scary or something. Right.
Yeah.
So I know, maybe as an example, though, other people's dreams are boring. I had one where there was one of these like movies you weren't supposed to watch because it would drive you insane. It's kind of like one of those Japanese horror movie things.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, in the dream, I had this back when I was getting my head shrunk back in my 20s. And in the dream, of course, me and my friends just start watching the movie immediately. And, you know, it has like different segments in it. And I remember after the first segment, I like paused it. And then he was like just cutting his own arm, just like completely lost his mind. And like in a dream, you should really like help that person. Mm-hmm. But in the dream, you don't, you just hit play again. Right. And they had a couple of vignettes in it, and I won't dwell on the other ones because other people's dreams are boring. But when you get to the end of it, it was like sort of a weird little thing. It was very short to tell. It was a guy who was walking on a road, like through a forest at night, and he was going to murder this woman in a house. And all you could see of the house was like this big white house. And you knew there was a woman inside. And so the guy was going to go murder this woman. Mm. And I woke up from this dream, like heart palpitating. And like, it was fucking scary to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that's terrifying. And I remember like during COVID, I was walking around talking with my son, and we were talking about scary dreams because he had this nightmare, which was a little similar about the unreliability of friendship, because he had a friend and there was a jar with a bunch of monsters inside of it. And he was telling his friend, don't open the jar, the monsters will fly out. And of course his friend immediately opens the jar, out come the monsters. But anyways, and I was like, I told him this dream of mine that I thought was really scary, and he was like, well, that's not scary at all. My monster dream, that shit was scary. This, I don't know what that was. And I was like, yeah, you know, people are drawing things that are scary. But the point was, you know, I knew this Fritz Perls thing, and like I started talking to the figures in the dream, just to give an example. And it was after I woke up. It wasn't like in the, you know, like a lucid dreaming. But that's cool. But I woke up and I was just like, let me ask the house what it thought. And the house was like, don't blame me. I'm just a house. I'm an innocent bystander in this whole thing.
Mm.
And then you ask the, you know, the figure who's the woman in the house who's going to get murdered. And she's like, ha, this guy's never going to make it here. He's going to die on the road anyways. He's never going to find me. Bah! And she was like kind of doing her nose thing with him. Like I'm kind of putting for the video, my thumb on my nose and like doing my fingers.
I think
she
wasn't call
afraid
that
of him at all.
Nana, nana, boo, boo.
It was a nana, nana thing. She was like not afraid of this guy even for a second.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, she was mocking him the whole time. And I was like, oh. And then there was the guy who was kind of like a shadowy figure. Probably would be a Jungian shadow, which was all of this kind of violence and anger. And I think as I started talking through it, what I realized it had a lot to do with like the family where I was raised. My dad was an explosively violent person. My mom was like kind of like a little bit like, my dad always called her histrionic. I don't know where he got that diagnosis, but she was like an attention seeking person, even if it was negative. And they had this battle to the death between them, right? And I think that's part of why it was so disturbing for me, right? Because it isn't as disturbing on the surface. You're watching a movie, shouldn't be that scary, right? But I woke up like, you know? And so that's an example of something from my own life, you know, just to like apply the technique. I don't know. That makes sense? I'm giving it as an example?
Yeah.
So anyways, but the thing is like, you're talking to your own mind. Now, the thing I think that Jung is saying is a little bit different, though. Maybe there's archetypal figures in this dream. Maybe that's the reason why it's scary too. The one guy's a shadow figure walking down the road. The other woman's probably some kind of anima figure, but like not a pleasant one, like back in the house or something, you know, like a some kind of internal feminine figure, but like not a pleasant aspect of the anima or something. Anyways, like you could look at it that way. The thing that gets me about this is that Jung's argument or Jung's point is when you get to this archetypal world, there's a certain magic within that. Because it has a power that isn't there within your normal kind of mind. And does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, I use, you know, well, let me, before I answer, how much longer do we have? Because I don't want to go into, I haven't talked about the journeying aspect, which is totally related to this, but like I need space.
Let's do it. If it takes like 15, 20 minutes, what the hell?
We'll okay, all right.
Make all this right. The whole episode, right? And then we'll call it.
Okay, fine. Yeah. So this active imagination and it's juxtaposed to a shamanic journeying practice in the way in which that I was taught, Mary Kay learned, that is represented by the Harner Foundation in this country. Michael Harner, he's written a couple books.
He's like a famous kind of shamanic person in the States, Daniel?
Yep, for sure. Okay, yeah, okay, he has cool. Cave in Cosmos, he wrote in 2016, and the other one is the Way of the Shaman. Written in like 1982,
right?
Very famous. Yeah. And so the use of repetitive sounds, generally 4 to 8 beats per second, produces a particular brainwave pattern. They've done research on this, so they kind of know it's the theta state. And then in this state, which you kind of referenced earlier as what did you call it, Eric? Reverie. Or hypnagogia.
Okay.
Yeah. That this particular theta state is tranquil but alert. You know, deeply tranquil, but still alert enough to interact. And so you have this repetitive noise, and generally drumming is used, that you are able to sort of quiet the mind in a sense, quiet the egos, or quiet the default mode network, or the chitter chatter, however you want to describe it. Enough so that you can have these visions. Now, the difference in journeying and active imagination is journeying, you're actually leaving yourself. In active imagination, you are descending into yourself. Now, a question may come up from people who don't know that they should ask it. Can you journey to yourself? Yes, you can. You can. So at some point, there's a little bit of a different thing, but I think
Is the journeying like going out into the world to get information that you wouldn't otherwise get about the external world? Is that the idea there?
So you brought something up earlier.
About going outside of yourself or inside of yourself. So I'm curious what that...
You're in journeying. When you journey, you're another synonym for journey is traveling. So we can call it traveling. Right, they call it astral projection or something like this. Meaning like not that you're going into the stars, which you can do, meaning that you're allowing your astral body to travel. And when we say astral body, maybe a better way of using this idea is using something from Chinese medicine out of the wood element associated with the liver and the gallbladder, talking about the dreaming body, the hun, probably okay. This, you know, so some aspect of yourself that can see and have vision and has some form, relative, tangible kind of form that will travel. Now, you can go anywhere. Anywhere is open to go. Past, present, future, space, underground, right here in this middle stage. You can go into a dream. But the thing, the difference is that like everything in your journey that you experience is alive. There is an energy to everything. Everything is interconnected. It is interconnectivity in a Buddhist sense, in utmost practice. So if there's two people, okay, so there's like that man, we'll use your dream. There's that man who was trying to do the killing, and then the woman in the house who you had fear for. There's them two that you could certainly interact with, but then there's the relationship between them that you could interact with. And this is a little bit of a different take. Same thing, you can interact with the house. You could interact.
Yeah, because in the house, I didn't take the house at face value. I thought the house was being a little bit dubious too.
Right.
Just a house. I'm an innocent house. Don't like look at me. Yeah.
Right. But the energy of that, like the containment of that. So you can interact with all the things. And what I tell people is that like in these states, we are interacting with different aspects of reality that have to relate to us because they probably are relatively formless. I don't mean formless without any form. They are formless than us. And so, but they have to relate to us on a psychic
level. Energetic dynamics that aren't showing themselves in very like obvious, you know, okay.
Got yes. It. Okay. And so then I'll use my shirt here. It's hard to describe, but imagine that if I had a sheet, okay, everybody knows what a sheet looks like. If I took my hand behind the sheet and pressed my fingers through, everybody who saw those fingers through the sheet, if they didn't know it was my hand that was behind it, probably would interpret that hand behind that sheet in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so in this way, when we are journeying, or in this case, we can call it active imagination, because I think they are probably the yin and yang paired practice. We have to be open to various forms of communication from this relatively formless energy, or this formless world, or this formless series of interactions, you know, and allow them to come through. And so the issue that most people have when they're doing active imagination, and more importantly, when they're doing journeying, because this has been something that, you know, I've been teaching now for the last, 9, 10 years that I learned with Mary Kay. I still teach courses with Mary Kay. I still learn from Mary Kay. It's an ongoing practice. People have a hard time believing what it is that they see because of their mind going blah, 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 you know?
A recurring theme of this whole deal. It's quite interesting. It is a recurring theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they can't do that because they immediately justify or rationalize everything that they see. I know what that is. Oh, I know what that is. I know how that's related. And they fill in the puzzle without actually doing any investigation. They do the recognition and acknowledgement part, but the investigation is just cut off completely. And so they're not able to
Too quickly dismissive. You kind of have the experience and you're like, okay, I know what it is. And that.
You say, I know what it is, or that's not real. Or that's related to that thing. So then you can close that loop, put it in a box and shove it back in your closet. You know what I'm saying? But you don't allow the things to unfold for various numbers of, various reasons. Some of which, again, there's a lot more because people are so dynamic, but some of which is fear, you know, much like why Carl Jung didn't want to express as other people, because some of it is fear.
A kind of like fear that can lead to things like repression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some of it is it fear that this might be something that is so, even though they're there to learn and the people are here to experience it, it's so far outside of their normal waking state mind flow that it's very difficult to grasp, even though they want to grasp it or they want to have it there. And the other part is that we do a lot of grasping. We want things to fit. And in the state we are in, again, relatively formless states. So if there is an energy of healing that wants to connect with me because I am here to connect with it for whatever karmic reason that might be the case, it's, you know, it may show up as a nurse, but it might show up as a bear, you know, or it might show up as something, you know, it could show up as something. And our inability to vary our ways in which we communicate hamper our ability to connect with them. So we're always looking for words. We're always looking for the visions. We're always looking for things that are very tangible. But in those states, rarely are you going to get, hi, I'm the healing spirit, and I'm here to help you with your childhood. Ha, ha, ha. You know, it's not going to be, it's going to be a deep knowing.
It's really funny because I have like in my notes the same kind of shit that we'll get to a little bit further on, but it's like the same ideas will keep because they're so important. There are the quintessential ideas, right?
Yeah. And so we have a very hard time. And I think it comes down to like levels of like trust and faith, actually, that we can believe in what we're seeing and extend ourselves in such a way that we lower our guard down to receive this information and take it in and go forth with it. You know, and I've taught many, many people, and many more people have had difficulty with it, to be totally honest. Most people, 8 out of 10 people, which is a huge surprise, can actually have visions and see these things, which is crazy to think. No psychedelic, no crazy amount of breath work, nothing like this. Just lay down, cover their eyes, hit some drums, and all of a sudden, here they're off, like seeing animals and things like this.
It's hypnagogic though, right? It is like that. Because you go to those places, probably every time you're falling asleep, you're having this experience.
Absolutely.
I pay attention to this in these Tibetan meditations because sometimes you're like, I can't sleep. And you're like, oh, now I'm going to fall asleep because I can see the fields, or I can see the water, or I can see the things. A lot of times it's nature, actually. It's interesting, right?
Yes.
A lot of nature imagery starts to pop up in it. It's not my specialty to do what you're talking about, but you know, but it's, but I obviously I do some of it. You do meditation enough, you're doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's though I don't have the training that you have, but it's fascinating. You know, it's like that.
And the practice for me, and Mary Kay probably would disagree with me, but at least the initial development of one's practice is having the sense of belief in what it is that you are experiencing.
Yeah, this is exact the next part of these fucking notes I have here.
That is, and I haven't read that. I haven't read that far.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying this is what happens when you get out of these subject matters.
Yeah, when you get in here, that's the hard part. That's the leap of faith, because there is, you know, between the acknowledgement and the inspection and then the kind of like moving forward with whatever the next piece is, it's not there's not a clear bridge, actually. Like, you have to be willing to come out and share that, like, I just had a conversation with Jesus. I had one time had a friend who literally said that. He's like, I didn't see much. I said, well, what happened? He's like, I don't know, man. I was walking on a beach and then I took some stairs up to the sky and I had a conversation with Jesus. And then he took me to some crazy city and then we talked some more and then he came back. But like, you know, I don't even know. Is any of this real or not? I was like, dude, what are you saying?
I like die of laughter. It's so funny.
You know, like people would beg for that in their whole life, and you just wrote it off like it's meaningless. You know,
oh, God damn, it's so funny.
You know, but that's what happens. And then other people, it's so incredulous to them that like they'll literally start. And I've had a new.
I don't think I've laughed that hard on any podcast we've.
It is funny, you know. I love him, he's great.
I still, my actual laugh friends. Like, I don't know how many times we've laughed on the podcast, but like that shit's funny. Well,
and I have one more. But then some people just, they can't at all. They rationalize everything away, and as soon as we're done, they Google, what does this mean, what does that mean? I'm like,
you talked about that. Yeah,
you know,
saw a walrus and I got some Beatles lyrics and I'm an Eggman and
yeah,
I'm a walrus, cuckoo ca-choo.
Yeah, that's it. And some people are so, and I don't know what it means about their psyche, but they're so blown away that they could even have any experience, they literally just cry. You know, they come out and they're just so tearful and joyful that like they didn't think that they deserved that kind of imagery in their lifetime.
That's actually very touching.
Oh, it's extremely touching.
Very moving. That's very moving.
And I've seen it a number of times. So not meaning to plug, but I'm going to teach next year again.
Okay, great.
Probably in February or March or something like this. And so I've been doing this for years. So this kind of subject matter is very near and dear to my heart. And I quite love it. And it's difficult to be able to break through, to touch the archetypal forces that are inherent within us all, I believe, because we're in our own way. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. That's been the theme of the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'll do the other part of this, and it's like exact parallelism to what you're talking about. But so, okay. In Jung, the point that comes up is that, you know, to get into this space, has an incredible power in Jung, and then like what we're agreeing in reality itself, right?
Yeah.
Like it's the real thing. And we had talked about these episodes with love and alchemy and synchronicity. So this is where the synchronicity thing starts to pop up again. And, you know, we had done the synchronicity thing a little bit when we talked about love, because what Jung's observation is, and it is true, when two people love each other, a bunch of synchronistic shit will start to happen around them. Like it actually happens, right? That's one of the indications that those two people love each other, is that a bunch of synchronicity will start to occur, right? This is Jung's observation. And I think anyone who's been, you know, like you seriously have loved someone, it happens. All of a sudden, all this synchronistic stuff starts to happen.
And if it doesn't, it doesn't mean that you're not in love. It
doesn't mean that. It does happen. If you're really in love with someone, it happens.
Yeah, it does.
When there's a lot of emotion, it happens.
Yeah. So it's like, this never happened to me.
I'm getting a divorce. It's up to you. It is true when people are really like something happens, that's because it's a spiritual event.
Yeah.
A chemical thing that happens. So things synchronize out and you get a lot of synchronicities. And like the thing about that is that it's very hard for people to believe that, actually. It's very hard for people to believe that, oh, it's synchronizing. I mean, I've had these conversations with people where you're like, okay, this is pretty massive synchronicity involving you in this person, or, you know, in our own lives with another person that we know. You'd be like, this is synchronicity. This tells you something important is happening. And people don't want to believe it, right? Because you have to somehow get to this. That's just an example, but it was one of the ones we talked about before, because we were talking about these love and relationship things. But it connects into this whole thing, because what's happening then is you're tapping into some deeper part of the world, kind of, right? The universe, right? Or something, right? You're tapping to some deeper level. And then in a certain sense, the difference between inside and outside starts to obscure.
Living meditation.
It's like, it's not, this is what Jung wrestled with in his own life in a way too, to figure out what he thought this meant, because all of a sudden the external world will start doing things that are reflecting aspects of your own inner states and emotions.
Yes.
And that's a weird experience, because all of a sudden you're interacting with something that is not only inside you, but is also outside you. The external world of feedback. I think that's the reason why this objective psyche phrase is kind of so interesting, because it's like he was using it to get to the point of like, okay, these are inner things inside of me, my own inner states of loving some other person and having the synchronistic events happening around that outside, or I meditate on an archetype and then things of that archetype start to appear in the world around me in ways that don't just seem coincidental anymore. Mm-hmm. Or don't just feel like all of a sudden I'm noticing something that was there all the time. They don't feel that way anymore. Mm-hmm. They have a certain thing where the inside and the outside is mirroring one another, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then this gets to the point that the archetypes are like then tied to the external world. And again, it could be true in like genuine love between people, where the universe will kind of start speaking, right? Or it'll be true when you get into archetypal aspects of things, right? And the mundane conceptions and appearances, to use the Buddhist tantric phrase, will start to kind of like not rule the day as much. And this other part of reality will start to like make itself more known, right? And you're outside the world of the default mode network, or the constriction Saturn world that we're talking about in kind of our episodes around Sophia and Yahweh. You're outside of that world. You're into a different part of the world. And it's very weird to think that that exists, but this is the synchronicity part. So I had to bring that part up next, because that's one of the next things that happens. Once you start getting into these deeper parts of yourself, you're tapping into like a deeper part of reality where, again, internal and external is not how we normally think of it as being, in the way that we'd see them in our, again, to use the phrase, mundane conceptions, mundane appearances of things. Those things start to get kind of blown away. Get something more on that before I talk about seven sermons to the dead.
No, I think we should cut it here though, to be totally.
Oh no, we got a little bit left in this part, so we might as well finish it.
A little bit left, okay.
Yeah.
Hold on one quick second here, Eric. Let me get this thing out 1 sec. All right, Eric, I was able to find what I needed, so we're good to continue.
Yeah, but the secret part is what we actually unrecorded, and we talked about whether we should just quit.
Right. Yes, that's exactly what happened.
And we agreed. Even though the smooth transition happened, smooth jazz transition.
That's right.
And I think we agree. So it seems like it's a place where we can kind of just do the other part of the experiential thing, but that's a kind of a good place to stop, right?
Yeah.
This whole idea of how, like, okay, if you can get to this part of yourself, then you're tapping into something outside of, you know, your, whatever you want to call it, your own default mode network, your own existential guardian operating system, your own mundane conception and appearances, the blah, blah, blah of your own complexes and your own minds and your own doubts and fears and insecurities and so on. If you can get outside of that, then you get into this deeper thing and then it hooks you up with the universe in a new way, right?
Mm-hmm.
How's that for an experiential episode ending? That's about as good as you can get, right?
It doesn't get any better.
I mean, that's probably how the journeying works too, which we can talk more next time, right? All of a sudden you get information from the external world that is available now because that line starts to blur, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we will pick up on it.
Yeah, I got a couple good stories too, you know.
All right, excellent. Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Eric, as always, thank you so much, brother. You know, we're doing this thing, audience. Thank you guys for rocking with us. I know I can't see you, but people do interact with us. So, you know, please feel free to drop a comment in the YouTube videos. We definitely get back to them. Or, you know, like, subscribe, do all that kind of stuff. I think everybody knows that standard thing at this point. It's like rote memorization. Yeah. Hit us up on Instagram, Jin and Tantra Podcast. We get back to those. JinandTantra@gmail.com. If you have a longer kind of message, you're welcome to hit us up that way. You know, share with friends or family or enemies or frenemies or your boss or somebody you're trying to influence to say, here's a subtle nudge of something you might want to listen to. You know, maybe we can influence their mind. So, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, you know, really influence people's minds and hearts, help to kind of shake loose some of the perspectives that that people have they may not even know they have, and vice versa. You know, I have learned a lot from book recommendations and things that our listeners have brought to us as we've been doing this, and also been very inspired by the changes that people have made to themselves via their sharing with us. Like, hey, I listened to your episode on this and I started reading this. And then, you know, like we love to hear that because it's, you know, it's why we do it. You know, honestly, like we do this as like I say all the time, this is a labor of love. You know, we're not monetized. We're not any of those kinds of things. We do this because we thoroughly enjoy it. You know, which that says something about us that
we narcissistically like to hear ourselves talk. I don't know.
Also that, being honest.
No, I think it's like the idea that, like, you know, you get to talk about things that have real existential deep meaning. Like this young stuff is deep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The journeying stuff is deep.
Yeah. Yeah.
The dream stuff is deep.
Mm-hmm.
Even though other people's dreams might be boring, that doesn't mean that they don't have real meaning to them. Jung loved dreams. I'm teasing about because Jung loved dreams, and Leo, like, it's just a joke. You know, he's always talking about his dreams constantly.
Yeah. So, thanks everybody for tuning in. We will definitely look forward to catching everybody in the next one. For Eric, this is Daniel. We'll see you soon. Peace. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. Together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together.